Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check.
Welcome to the Quick Restart. We cover 73 Division I men's lacrosse teams.
And we do it fast.
Thank you for coming to the first ever Quick Restart podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Quinn Kesnick. And Quinn, first of all, I want to apologize to our listeners of our season preview podcast. Apparently, I didn't do a good enough job leveling out our audio, and I might have broken one of our listeners' Sonos sound systems because I was too loud. So that's my bad. That's on me. We're going to get that fixed. Early season problems, right?
Yeah, we move on. We make adjustments, and we continue to move forward with a positive mindset, understanding that about 20 or so the 73 Division I teams were in action this weekend in real games, the others in scrimmages. So there's a lot to talk about.
And the conversation will continue throughout the week on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. For those of you that didn't see the plan that we announced last week, basically you and I are going to be talking over the course of the weekend for the rest of the season, and we're going to hit you either sometime on Sunday or Monday morning with our, as the name suggests, quick reactions. And then Kyle Devitt and Dan Averin are going to come back on Tuesdays with the In the Crease podcast. Wednesdays will be a day designated for either Division II or Division III conversation. And then until the high school season starts, we're going to be hearing from Steven Stamp on the Box Will Beat. He's going to be talking about the NLL. And then the High School Lacrosse podcast will come back, the Al Press podcast. And then Friday, Mark Dixon and Dan Flynn are going to preview the weekend. They're going to take the baton from us. I think that's a really high standard that we've set over the last 2 years, right, buddy?
Yeah, you know, it's a constant churning machine, kind of like McDonald's.
So we've got a weekend of lacrosse to talk about. Before we dive in, would you consider this weekend zero or weekend negative one?
I think it's like week zero, because college football has a similar what we call week zero, and it's some ancillary games prior to everybody really starting on the 9th other than the Ivy League. So I'm labeling it week zero.
So the games that I watched closely were the two debutantes. So I saw Vermont beat Utah 21-6 on Friday evening, and then at 11 a.m. on Saturday, watched High Point shut out St. Bonaventure 13-0. You know, the thing about those two games that I didn't realize until after I watched both of them is that for the new opponents, you know, they were playing teams that you would consider to be appropriately talented, teams that traditionally have been ranked in the 30s. The difference between them and some of the other similarly talented teams and why it was such a bad opponent for each of these two first-year programs to play in their first varsity game is because they're both so well coached that they were uniquely positioned to take advantage of the mistakes that these teams were going to make. And it was never better exemplified than, I believe it was High Point's fourth goal of the day. It was an extra man goal. And coming out of a dead ball restart on man up, Asher Nolting started with the ball on the wing, and nobody played him. No St. Bonaventure defenseman stepped out to play him. He just went straight to the goal and scored. And, you know, these defensive communications issues were huge problems for both teams. It was hard to take too much away from what we're going to see out of Vermont and High Point the rest of the season, but certainly a celebration for both teams as they got their programs officially, they officially got their feet wet.
Yeah, and for comparison's sake, you know, I think it points to the wonderful job that's been done at places like Richmond and Jacksonville and Michigan and Marquette, in how those coaches were able to ramp their programs up to competitive status and challenging for NCAA you know, league tournaments pretty quickly. So there's a high standard that's been set by some of those new programs.
And it's an interesting consideration for a coach. You know, we were talking about it on Friday night because I was watching with Josh Davey, Dan Averin, and new Inside the Cross employee Patrick McEwen about what do you say to your team in the end game huddle when you just lost 21-6 if you're Coach Brian Holman. And it depends on what you think their mood is and what the preparation's been like. But for me, I'd be so tempted. It would be so hard to resist the temptation to say, I told you so. We've been telling you guys for months, if not years, that the standard is higher than you're ready for. And with the exception of Jimmy Perkins, who's a Robert Morris transfer, Liam Donnelly, who spent a year as a redshirt season at Rutgers, you know, all these guys that have MCLA experience or high school experience, just they couldn't be prepared for how steep the curve is at the Division I level. And the reason that I told you so is so tempting is because if you can convince them that what you're telling them is the right thing, then hopefully it makes this week of practice a lot easier.
Vermont's going to be a pretty darn good team. I liked what I saw in their scrimmage against Syracuse, minus a couple of referees' calls that allowed Syracuse to score some extra man goals. Vermont stood toe-to-toe with the Orange in that scrimmage on January 26th, I believe it was. So that's a tough opener. The fact is that Utah and St. Bonaventure don't have fully stocked Division I roster talent on spots 1 through 45, and it's going to take 3 to 4 years to get to that point.
Just a couple guys that I want to mention for fans that weren't able to watch the games. I thought Josh Stout, the attackman who finished with 3 goals for Utah, he was the leading scorer on last year's MCLA team. He's from Utah. I thought he was really impressive. Speaking with a couple of folks who were at the Marquette scrimmage leading up to this past weekend, the word on the street was Josh Stout could play at pretty much any program in the Big East. And I thought that he proved that with his performance, particularly his ability to put solid Division I defensemen on their heels and create pressure. And then for St. Bonaventure, not a ton of positives to take away, but I thought Brett Dobson, the goalie who I believe finished with 13 saves, did a really nice job in that. Actually, he had more than that because he definitely finished above 50%, maybe 16 saves. Did a really nice job kind of, you know, preventing this from being a lot uglier than it otherwise could have been.
You know, St. Bonnie is in good hands with Randy Mearns. And to me, the thing that stands out about the Utah moving forward is the visuals, you know, the great visuals of that team and their uniforms and on the field, nice crowd of over 3,000, the excitement that it generated in Salt Lake. And they'll move forward and the dreams that it creates. You know, if you're a youngster and you go to that game and you live up in that Utah Valley and you're thinking about adding lacrosse to your resume, you know, if you're a middle school or a high school kid, and now you have a stone cold reason why you should be playing lacrosse, and there's an end game. And so the dream is created, and that's a tremendous positive for the sport. Love the fact that it was on the Pac-12 network, and it got so much attention because it deserved it. It was an historic moment, and now Utah gets to go back and try to improve and recruit talent from all across the country.
Well, let's move on to what I consider to be the biggest result of the weekend. Penn State 17, Villanova 7. This game was originally scheduled to be the opening of a newly refurbished Panzer Stadium. It was moved indoors to Huluba Hall, a very difficult place to play with the backdrop because of the low temperatures. And honestly, it was never really close. This was the game that Nova won last season. It was the game that we found out right pregame that Grant Ament had been injured, that, you know, tipped off a when will he return conversation that ultimately ended with not this season. He'll return in 2019, and boy, did he, to the tune of 10 points. This game featured Penn State leads of 3-0, 6-2, and ultimately 17-5. And the reason that you can't sleep on this result, this Villanova team was an NCAA tournament team last year. They started 5-0. They beat Yale on the heels of their Penn State season opening victory. They were 10-4 at one point before losing to Georgetown in the Big East semifinals and then losing to Duke in the first round of the NCAA tournament. Sure, they graduated a pair of really talented seniors at the attack, specifically Connor Cuccinella, who is their leading scorer. But the fact that this game was not competitive really stood out to me, and certainly in addition to Grant Ament's performance, Colby Kinese in goal had a tremendous day.
I don't think there's any doubt that Penn State's a top 8 team, okay? I think at one point last year they were ranked number 1, or maybe that was 2 years ago. Hashtag We Are made a statement, though. This was an eye-opening win, really the eye-catcher of the opening weekend. You add Ament to a stable of capable scorers, 11 different guys, you know, got involved. What I didn't like was the fact that Colby Kinese had to make 19 saves after Gerard Arceri won 14 of 16 of the draws he took. So, you know, they certainly can tighten up the defense. Freshman TJ Malone had a hat trick. He was a late recruit, kind of flipped from Amherst, I believe, to Penn State. He's a player right away. I have high expectations for this Penn State team. Everything I see says that the Nittany Lions can challenge for the supremacy in the Big Ten this year.
One note to watch, Kevin Hill left the game with an injury, I believe, after scoring three goals. But Matt Kinnear was on site in State College. So why don't we go ahead and hear from some of the Nittany Lion contingent.
A year ago, you know, you were walking around here in a boot.
Yeah.
How's it just, you know, looking back on that, how's it feel just to be out here?
Yeah, it was, my mom texted me this morning. I was in breakfast this morning, and at this time last year I was in surgery. So it's been a long year. I'm just grateful to be out here, myself as well as Tommy Wright and Brandon Stern. Kind of the three of us were the injured guys last year. Just to be out with those guys, all wearing the jersey is a fun experience. It's been a while.
I think you had 4 points on the first four goals there. That get any kind of jitters, anything out of the way pretty early for you?
No, I mean, it's I wouldn't say it's like riding a bike, but I mean, once you get back out there, it's kind of the exact same, especially when you have kind of the same personnel out there. It's very easy to play with guys like Kevin Hill, Nick Spillane, Mac, Jack Kelly, TJ Malone, Dylan Foles. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. I had those 4 points, but three of them were assists off of great cuts by them. And I mean, they seemed to get open a lot today, which made my job pretty easy.
How nice is it to have TJ kind of step up as a freshman and be as good as
he is? Yeah, I mean, TJ and I definitely have an interesting relationship because he was a freshman and I was a senior at Haverford. Just to see him shine, he's an incredibly hardworking kid, very, very technical in his craft. So him and I get along very well in that aspect. And he, just to see him come out, he brings a smile to the field every day. Just to see all that hard work for him pay off, it's fun.
Coming back, I want to head down to College Park, Maryland, where the Terps opened their season with an 11-6 victory over Bucknell. They were led by Logan Wisnoskis, who benefited from all of the defensive attention paid to guys like Bubba Fairman and Jared Bernhardt. That's Quinn, that's a mistake I'm going to make like all season long. It's going to be brutal. And ultimately, I think that it's fair to say that the Terps grinded out a win.
Wisnoskis had 4 goals on 4 shots, but he also turned the ball over 5 times. Anthony DeMeo came off the bench and chipped in 3 points, which is positive. You got a two-headed face-off monster in Justin Shockey and Austin Henningsen. They split the reps. I think that's an area of strength. Nice little crowd, almost 2,000. Maryland is now 93-1 all-time in openers. That is unbelievable. Got some new faces. Danny Dolan between the pipes. He was sharp, especially in the second half. And Brett McCarr, a freshman, started down low on defense with Jack Welding and Curtis Corley. So you see some new faces in the Terps roster, and you see some established faces. Scoring goals, I think, from the midfield especially is going to be the challenge initially for John Tillman. This team is not going to wow anybody, but, you know, if one thing we know about Maryland, they're going to be well-coached, they're going to play their guts out, they're going to be tough in the specialty areas, they're not going to beat themselves, and this team is just firmly entrenched in the top eight because of their culture, because of their talent, because of their coaching. There's a lot to like here, and I thought it was a good starting point. 11-6 win over Bucknell, who fought hard. You know, Bucknell only played 17 guys, and gave it their all, but Maryland gutted it out, and they'll move forward. They play Richmond next week at noon. That game's BTN Plus, Terps and Richmond in College Park.
Bucknell only played 17 guys, is that right? I didn't see that. Wow, that's
according to the box score. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, okay. I want to come back to that. There are a couple more games that I want to get to before we talk about reactions to the first time that we saw the rules in game action. But we also heard from John Tillman, so let's go ahead and do that now.
Obviously, great to start the 2019 season, and very proud of the guys. Kind of what we expected, a real good Bucknell team, got on the board first and had to fight and scrap. Wasn't pretty, but proud of the effort, proud of our guys, the energy, the leadership, proud of a lot of the young guys that got their first opportunity. So total team win, and certainly I think we grew from the experience, but even the preparation, getting ready, I thought we really improved this week. I think as a coach, you always have things that you want to make sure that you focus on. But I had a lot of confidence in this group, just because of the way they've approached things, the leadership that we have. I think like most coaches, you have concerns about, did we cover enough? Did we prep them hard enough? But I think these guys were ready. The guys that, maybe hadn't been household names, they've been working really hard since August. So we really felt like when they got the opportunity, they were going to make the most of it. His first goal of the year is Christian Zawadzki, a senior, fifth-year guy. It's battled some injuries, and I couldn't be more excited for him. I know the team. I speak for them, and they're super excited for him to step in with that confidence. That's kind of what we're hoping for is, when they put too much emphasis on some of our veteran guys like a Bubba or Logan or Jared, I think we have a lot of other capable guys like he and Lewis Dubik that really can do some damage. I thought Danny gave us everything we could have asked for in his first start and more. I think he got better as the game went on. I thought he made some good decisions in the clearing game. Certainly some things to improve upon, but for a fifth-year guy to step in and really get 11 saves and have 10 in one half, to me just speaks to his prep and how hard he's worked and all the extra effort he puts in after practice every day. It's funny, I think you'll see a really deep ride or a really aggressive ride. So pressing down to forecheck you so the ball stays down there, or really condensing the middle of the field so it's hard to find somebody to play off that 20-second clock. So we tried to put in some simple things this week because Bucknell, they'll kind of mimic the 10-man. Sometimes they're in a 9.5, meaning they'll kind of step out the goalie. But not that far, so it's really not a 10-man, because in a 10-man, the goal's open. So he'll kind of step out and then get back in, so you can't really shoot it there. And at other times, they'll just kind of press down, and they'll yell, and it almost, you get that sense that the 10-man's coming. So the guys did a really good job with it. The first one was a little bit dicey, but we got it from there. So the guys did a good job with it. The hope was if we could win today, with all the things they did, I really thought the preparation for this game would really help us. We got multiple rides that we had to go against. They ran some zone. We saw a couple different zones. They run a very complicated defense. So to prepare for all that, we hope that maybe that being under our belt would be helpful going forward, especially with these young guys. I think, listen, some guys I thought that did a really good job today. I thought, Justin Shockey was good in the second half. The faceoffs got better. West Janik and our wing guys were great. And I think our transfer guys, Caramonte and Alex Smith, were terrific today. Just really helped us. So, some of those new guys and even Russ Massey and Kyle Bricker were great. We made a switch. Justin got more in the second half. And I thought we were fine in the first half. I think we were about 50%. And Tyler Barbridge does such a good job with those guys all week. Some of the guys, we try to give them different looks. We have four guys down there, that Hogpen group. And I think Ty just giving him some of those looks are helpful. It was unique. We decided to go with Austin, but really the battle was there are two guys from Landon. Jared Witzel is a senior who went to Landon, and Justin Shockey was a sophomore when Jared was a senior. So they knew each other pretty well. So we didn't know how that would go. You got a guy who's a couple years older that might, obviously have a little something to prove, but then you got obviously a younger guy who's technically pretty good. So I thought all in all, Justin made some good decisions. Our wing play was pretty good. We just got to clean up our turnovers. I think we had a ton of turnovers today, so if we can get better at that, which at this time of the year you hope that we can improve upon. But the kids will stay focused. They've been a good group so far. We've been fine with it all year. We kind of felt like the shot clock really hasn't impacted us. It impacted us a little more today just because Bucknell slides and recovers so much that, they don't let you get to the goal on that first dodge. So you're constantly moving. And, we could win matchups, and get some leverage, but they kept sending a guy, which means you got to move it. And then they do such a good job of recovering that if you don't move it really fast, all of a sudden you got to generate leverage again. So that forced us to really stick work the ball, and if you have a bad stick work situation, you drop it, now you got to reset it again. So it's been great. With us, we've been working on it since August with clocks and practice and things like that. I think that the kids did a great job today with some short time situations, like Logan's goal, like where, all right, it was getting late, we got organized, and they, you know, obviously made something happen instead of just chucking it to the corner. And you're right, there are a couple times late where we're like, listen, if we can kill 80 seconds, up five goals, at this point, we'll probably do that.
So, Quint, staying in the Big Ten, a game that I wasn't able to watch, but I did follow closely, check out the highlights, and talk to some folks who were in attendance afterwards. Ohio State 12, Cleveland State 9, Jack Jasinski 5 points, Trey LeClaire 3 goals. I thought that, you know, this was a game that if you look at it and kind of slice it a couple different ways, you made the comment with respect to Colby Knieze's performance and the fact that you didn't want to see him have to have such a big day given their face-off advantage. Josh Kirsan made 16 saves for the Buckeyes. Cleveland State did not get a point from their starting attack. They got 8 goals from their bench. They got a really nice day facing off from Danny Tesler, over 50% against a really highly regarded face-off unit for the Buckeyes. Despite a 3-goal loss, considering it was on the road, it was indoors, and it was the first game of the season, there's a lot of positives to take away if you're Dylan Sheridan and his team. And there are aspects of this game that Cleveland State outplayed Ohio State.
Yeah, the score last year was 13-6. So there's no question that the Vikings are taking big steps forward. Ohio State coming off kind of a rough season. Not sure where to slot this team right now. One thing I'll tell you, Nick Myers and his staff, Brad Ross, Travis Crane, an outstanding staff, as professional as it gets, and they will move forward off of this first game. They've got an outstanding record indoors there in Columbus. They hardly lose. I mean, that is a place that opponents go to fall because it's hot and Woody Hayes, and they typically play well in a huge home field advantage. So this was a good showing for Cleveland State.
Just whipping around real quick. Wagner, OT winners 7-6 at Bellarmine. This is a meaningful victory for a couple of reasons. Number one, you know, Wagner is a team that prior to Matt Posky's arrival, I believe had 3 winless seasons in a row, 0-45, I want to say from like 09 to 11, somewhere in that stretch. So the bottom can fall out really quick. And given that, you know, there was a pretty late in the fall transition in coaching as Paske moved to the Division III ranks and Bill McCutcheon was a relatively late hire, the fact that they were able to go and beat a Bellarmine team that is also under a first-year head coach in Jim Mitchell but has definitely scored some significant victories over the course of time, has been competitive in the SoCon, you know, that's meaningful for Wagner to stay at least at a certain level, a really nice kind of season opening win for them. And then just kind of cruising the box score a little bit, I was impressed by the contributions that North Carolina got from their freshman in a 20-9 victory over Mercer in Atlanta, played at Centennial, the alma mater of Nikki Solomon, a freshman attackman who debuted with to the tune of a couple goals and was complimented by Jacob Kelly, another freshman attackman who made his debut and got on the score sheet early. In addition to that, Zach Tucci, who was the late addition to the class at the faceoff position, that was a really interesting recruiting story involving, you know, the departure from his commitment to Harvard and the spot in their class that opened up by virtue of Ricky Miazon's decision to play football at Stanford. I thought that there were some positives to take away from North Carolina.
I ran into Ricky at a Stanford game I covered this year. They redshirted him. He's going to play inside linebacker. They love him. He's got size. He's got speed. He's going to be a player for Stanford in the future. It's somebody we can hang our hat on as having ties to lacrosse. In terms of the Tar Heels, you know, freshman Jacob Kelly out of Calvert Hall had 8 shots, started at attack, okay? And so they bumped Timmy Kelly up to that first midfield, kind of running out through the box. Joe Bresci was able to play 37 different members of the roster. And if you look at the score sheet, you know, they had 12 different goal scorers. A bunch of defenders and Poles got involved in the scoring action. That's good to see. They started strong, 6-1 first quarter, which you like to see. And they forced a bunch of turnovers, especially Mercer really struggled to clear the ball. And I would like Carolina with their athleticism to turn up the tempo, so to speak, to play to their strength, to play to the depth of that roster. There's good athletes in spots, let's say 15 through 25. I think a faster paced game would favor this Carolina team this year.
You mentioned Timmy Kelly's move to the first midfield alongside William Perry and Justin Anderson, who were on that first midfield last season. Those guys combined for 7 goals and 11 points, a really productive top unit. That what's interesting about that to me, though, is that Tanner Cook ran with Perry and Anderson for a good portion of last season. Obviously, there were some injury issues that, you know, created a little bit of fluctuation, and Timmy Kelly playing a little bit of attack contributed to that as well. But what's fascinating is in the shot clock era, when fatigue presumably is going to be a bigger part of the equation because there's less time to rest on the field, more moving from end to end, even if you're not sprinting, even if you're jogging in a clear or whatever, like fatigue is just going to be a bigger deal. You're going to have to rest more on the sideline. The number one midfield, you know, where we've seen number one midfields take as many as 85, 90% of the runs for their team in the recent past, it doesn't feel like that's going to be available. And I'm fascinated by how coaches are going to react to needing to play additional midfielders or additional midfield lines. And it seems like Carolina's decision was, we want to put a guy who is a bona fide first line midfielder in Tanner Cook on our second unit, and he's going to be the guy on the second unit. And he responded with 2 goals and 3 assists. When we talk about Duke, we can talk about a similar choice made with Mekhi Montgomery and how that had a cascading effect. But what do you think of that notion as to how coaches are going to try to delineate or distribute the minutes among their offensive midfielders?
Well, in the past, it seems as if teams have stacked their first midfield and hope to get a couple runs out of that second group and kill time and work your offense more through the attack when the second group's been in the game. And there's been a big drop-off, quite frankly, between teams' first and second midfield. Maybe they'll be more balanced this year. I'd like to see that. You know, I used to think that having a second midfield that could score points was a big differential in playoff games. That has become less of a factor in the last decade.
One other thing, and I want to transition to talking about the rules directly, but one other thing that stands out from the box score in the Carolina-Mercer game, obviously 29 goals scored, but 90 shots taken, 55 for the Tar Heels and 35 for the Bears.
Yeah, well, Carolina, you know, at Mercer, they got Furman next on Saturday, and Furman's coming off that Duke game, and then Harvard, and then they turn things up on the 23rd, hosting Johns Hopkins, and they host Denver the following weekend. So for this Carolina team, coming off a rough season last year where they went 7-7, it's a nice little way to start the season, I think, where you start slow, you build confidence, you figure out who you are prior to your tough games on the 23rd and March 2nd.
Well, and the biggest difference between this schedule and last year's is that they really kind of front-loaded those winnable games, and they started 6-0, and then they didn't necessarily have a winnable game, and that's why they went, I believe, 1-6 or 1-7 down the stretch. After those Johns Hopkins and Denver games, they kind of pressed the reset button a little bit with Marist on a Friday, Bucknell on a Tuesday, Cleveland State the following Sunday. So in the span of 11 days, say they do fall to 3-2, they have an opportunity to quickly get back to 6-2 before taking on Maryland in College Park on March 23rd.
Yeah, and you know, that there are really fascinating schedule dynamics at work in the month of February. There are some who play super high-quality non-conference games that you need to win and need to play well in. There are others who play more lower-level teams and use them as glorified scrimmages. Probably pretty sure that we're going to get the W if we show up mentally and physically. And that you need to move forward off of those wins. So there's two different schools of thought in how to approach the month of February.
Let's talk about the rules directly. I didn't really notice the shot clock in the two games that I watched closely. And it's not to say I didn't notice it in the sense that it was on the screen on the Pac-12 network, although, and I appreciate that, I will say I'd prefer to be a countdown from :80 as opposed to 1:20. So that's something to be mindful of. For a lot of the web streams, including ESPN Plus games, it was not on the screen. Saw some indications from Chris Yastrzemski, who's a coordinating producer, I believe, or a producer for part of the production team for ESPN games, that they've created a score bug that will include the shot clock. So certainly expect to see that for ESPN production going forward. Did you notice the way that the shot clock impacted the play on the field?
In these games, I did not. You know, to me, more concern was the 20 seconds to clear. I found myself holding my breath more on in those scenarios. And we're going to see coaches now react to that 20 in terms of riding. Are we aggressive? Do we press down low? Do we back off, drop, try to sub and shorten the clock? You know, what's our best way to clear? You know, can our shorties and our LSM do the job right away and we transition with it without a headache? And then the dive rule, I think, is going to be, very much a work in progress because
we're going to get there.
Yeah.
So, but before you move off of the shot clock, one thing I wanted to mention is the notion of changing sub patterns. I mentioned Matt Kinnear was in Haluba Hall. When you go and you're kind of covering a game there, you're sitting at the end of one of the team's benches, and it gives you a really good insight as to what these guys do when they come off the field, how tired they actually are. And he said he didn't really notice a significant difference in fatigue level or substitution patterns. And I would also say that I didn't really notice a change in the box length. You know, that was something that coming into this season I thought was going to be an under-the-radar consideration given how, you know, it was going to affect transition opportunities, particularly because it essentially decreases the advantage that the riding team gains when they subbed an offensive midfielder off and a D-middie on. You know, they're losing 10 yards compared to last year and the years in which the box was 20 yards wide as opposed to the 10 yards that it is right now. But I did not notice an uptick in transition offense or transition offense opportunities that were previously going to be, you know, kind of attempted and bailed out. It wasn't as if I saw a bunch that, you know, the team decided to go to the goal in a situation where they probably wouldn't have previously.
Well, the stone cold 4-on-3 fast breaks are shrinking in the game. Okay. By minimizing the box, as you said, you've decreased to a 20-yard advantage that the defense used to have. Where that's going to show up is subtlety 5-on-4s, 6-on-5s for the offensive team, where that second or third sub is not in time. He loses his advantage, and so teams can push the delayed break, the 6-on-5 or the 5-on-4.
All right, so let's talk about the dive. The notable play that made its rounds on social media on Saturday night was Furman, offensive player. I think he was playing midfield, but I believe to a degree he played attack over the course of his career. But I believe it was William Holcomb, ISO'd from the bottom right, got underneath his defenseman, and attempted to dive. Duke's goaltender, I believe it was Turner Upgren, stepped out. He had his left foot outside of the crease, his right foot in the crease, absorbed the contact. Holcomb was able to get his stick underneath the goalie and finish, and the goal was disallowed, and it was ruled a one-minute unsportsmanlike on Holcomb, on the attacking player. And in addition to these considerations, was what the defensive player's role in this was, whether he pushed him in the back, et cetera. And so, yes, there were a couple of executed dives that were allowed, really cool plays that made the rounds, and that will continue to happen. But the issue that this arises for me is, and I had this reaction early on, what disincentive is there for the goalie to fly out and initiate contact, especially if it's going to be deemed that he's allowed to do it when he's outside of the crease? I just don't get it. There's no way to effectively dive if the goalie is going to cut off that angle so substantially.
That's something that hasn't changed. You know, when I played was the beginning of the dive era, when Gary Gate changed the rules of the game. Okay, when guys like Michael Watson and Doug Knight changed the rules, changed the angles of offense. And if you were a passive goalie, you were toast, okay? Your only chance to stop a dive was to be the aggressor, to be the defensive slide man, to be there at goal line extended, to get to the tangent of the crease, to become active in the defense, to stop the dive. And many times it meant contact. And my mentality was, a guy's going to dive, fine. He's going to dive, and I'm going to crush him. I'm going to try to put him out, to let him know that this is my turf and you don't come anywhere near here without knowing that I'm going to physically check you as hard as I can to the chest ride my hands and stick up your neck into your Adam's apple and jam it in your jaw and try to break your neck as you land. Okay. That's how I played the dive. And if that's a penalty on the offense, hooray.
So I guess that's the answer. And that's going to totally prevent dives all in all. Like, can you paint a picture in which the goalie will not have the ability to go out and initiate contact? And I guess my question is, like, it didn't seem as if goalies initiating contact was a significant problem or a significant defense of the dive the way it is utilized in pro lacrosse.
No, you know, I think that's because those goalies played collegiate ball in a passive system where diving was illegal, so it's never on their mind. But you know, from day one, when guys would inside roll and attempt to dive across the crease, I've got to be there. If I can be there, boom, and make contact as that player turns from that inside roll, you know, my defenders were trusting that I'd be there to help them out if we didn't have a coma slide coming that way. And that's just – that was par for the course. I wasn't the only guy. And you know, attackmen – learn to realize who's in goal when they're operating around the crease area. But I think that playing in high school and playing in college without a dive, then you transition to the MLL that has it and you're not prepared. You have no training ground. You have no history of making these type of plays around the crease.
So let me ask you, because I'm not certain that I actually feel like I know what your answer is. Do you like this dive rule? Do you think it's going to be a little bit cleaner than the expectation is right now?
No, I think it's going to be a little bit of a mess because, you know, I can – if I'm in the attack player and I dive tangent of the crease but land in the crease, let's say, not towards the goal line or the goalie, a smart goalie is going to come out and try to create contact and try to buy that one-minute call. You're much better off doing that than you are being passive and staying with your heels on the goal line.
Okay. All right, well,
true or false, if you stay and keep your heels on the goal line, you will never get that call. You must step off your goal line and become a defender and become an athlete there to try to draw that call. The gray area for me are contact with defenders where a guy's attempting to dive towards the tangent away from the goalie and gets bumped, or the second slide comes in and redirects the diver towards the goalie. Those are more complicated scenarios that are going to be really a handful to officiate.
So let's talk about this Duke 17-9 win over Furman. I think that the answer to this question is clear cut and dry. What stood out to you most about this game?
That I had forgotten that John Danowski was sitting at 399. We had all these graphics built for the national championship game last year. You know, post game, had they won, he would have hit 400 in an NCAA final. Think about how magical that would be. And then when I first saw you guys post that on Twitter and you put up 400, I said to myself, I forgot for a second. I said, that's a misprint. He can't have 400. It's got to be 300. And I did the math. I asked my daughter, I said, Grace, what's 12? What's 400 divided by 12? Let's say you average 12 wins a year. And she goes, 33, Daddy. I'm like, 33 years of 12 wins a season gets you to 400. That's insane. And then I went back and I looked at the bio and it hit me how long this guy's been doing it and how well he's been doing it. 27 games at post, 21 years at Hofstra. 21 years at Hofstra, a career in itself, 192 wins there. Then obviously taking over Duke when that program had bottomed out and taken what was a really, really bad situation and building it into a dynasty, winning three titles along the way and, you know, repetitively winning 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 or more games a year. But more than that, you know, just the impact that he's had on all those teams and all those young men. He's a true teacher, you know, he started in the classroom like Tony Seaman did, like Bill Tierney did. They're teachers first, which is so important. Using the lacrosse field as their classroom. Danowski's a complicated figure because, you know, he's got that, 1970s rock and roll style to him, you know, Steely Dan and the Blues and Little Feet. But at his core, he's pretty much there's not much gray area when it comes to John Donowski and how he wants his players to play and practice. And I think if you'd ask him what his focus was today, right now, and looking at the 400, he'd say probably say the most important thing about today is upcoming at 3 o'clock when we go out in the field for 2 hours and practice and hope to improve on the effort that we showed in that win against Furman. I love working with John Donowski and covering his games. I learned so much being around people like him and Bill Tierney and Tony Seaman and Dave Cottle. They have such expertise in the X's and O's, but more so in their ability to motivate, handle, and deal with young people.
So that's obviously an excellent answer, and I appreciate you laying that out. That being said, it is not my answer. My answer is Jake Seau, a player who I did not realize was still on the Duke roster. He's a grad transfer. He redshirted in 2015. Or not a grad transfer. He's a grad student, redshirted in 2015. Played in 13 games, started twice, finished the season with 5 points last year. He had 2-2.
C.J. Carpenter had a hat trick. Cam Bedore, who I warned fans about, also scored 3 goals. So you had some faces that you don't recognize. It was almost as if, hey, wait a second. Where are the normal names here? Where's the Joey Manown? Where's the Gutterding? Well, he's gone. But it was a lot of new faces, which is a huge positive.
But that's not what I'm getting at. What I'm getting at is this, I guess, kind of like career reclamation project that Jake Seau is starting. Like, if this continues, like, I don't know. This is a story that I'm really fired up about. If Jake Seau can continue to be a 1-2-3 point first line midfielder for Duke throughout the course of this season, and I, you know, that's a pretty high standard on the basis of what he's shown. Like, that'll be one of the most interesting and surprising, like, because people forget about how much buzz there was about this kid coming out of high school and the fact that he's not, you know, he's suffered with injuries and he's not received, or he's not, you know, achieved a certain level of production over the course of his career. You know, if he's able to do this in his fifth season in college, when, you know, again, I think that a lot of folks had kind of mentally moved on, man, that would be a remarkable, remarkable point of achievement for sure.
Yeah, and I agree. And his journey, it's great to see him back in it because he has been written off by a lot of folks. But every time he went out there and you saw him in the practice field, he always stood out at, you know, 6'2", 200. Many times he wasn't in uniform. Many of my trips to Durham, Seau was not participating. He was still a member of the team for whatever injury reason. And for him to come back now as a graduate is really quite a story. Get on it, Terry.
A couple other things. So in the wake of Brad Smith's injury news last week, one of the conversations I had was, all right, if you look at their, you know, because to me he was going to be their quarterback. Now, whether that was, you know, kind of a Connor Kelly right wing style player who can play attack or play midfield, you know, it was going to be a little bit TBD. But if it wasn't going to be him, my second bet was going to be Joe Robertson. And the reason for that was because that lefty goal scorer's transition into a quarterback is something that I think for a lot of folks is the least likely transition. And yet we saw Connor Fields and Justin Gutterding do it over the course of their career. So I was like, oh, is this something that Robertson might be capable of that the rest of us just don't see or wouldn't expect? Now, I wasn't able to watch this game, so I can't speak to that closely, but the fact that he was productive, 4-1 on 12 shots, only one turnover, is really meaningful. Another thing that stood out to me is Brian Smith took 27 faceoffs. Joe Stein, who really impressed me and kind of, I don't want to say salvaged their faceoff position, but certainly provided a spark in the middle of last season, was really meaningful. And then the last one, I mentioned this earlier in the context of Tanner Cook leading the second midfield unit, Nekhai Montgomery filling that same role for the second midfield in terms of being a known quantity who was going to be a catalyst. You know, I thought that was really interesting to watch. And then the last one I'll mention is Garrett Ledman, a highly touted freshman midfielder, shooting 0-for-5. You know, it's a tough transition to make, particularly in your first game. But I would expect that he's going to continue to get looks over the course of this season.
And that's an area where freshman midfielders typically struggle the most is that shot on the run. You know, big, good-looking kid out of DeMatha, 6'3", 215. I remember from the Under Armour game. He's got the most points in DeMatha history. It's more than Paul Rabel. Played a lot there. 4-year starter. Also a high school football player. So he will learn the finer points of midfield scoring. You know, Nakai Montgomery didn't score any goals, but I didn't get to watch the game, but a box score is not going to tell us how many doubles he drew and what kind of party starter that Nakai was. My guess is that he was leaving some people in his wake and drawing double and triple teams and then distributing.
One more game I want to get to before we wind this down and hand the baton on to Dan and Kyle to talk about the rest of these games in more or all these games in greater detail on Tuesday. Detroit 9, Jacksonville 8. Seth Mendel led the scoring for the Titans, 3 goals, 1 assist. Alex Jarzembowski went 15 of 21 into faceoff X, added 2 goals. Logan Chamberlain made 15 saves. That performance at the faceoff X is particularly notable given Jacksonville's graduation of Hunter Forbes and how much of an asset he was last year. I thought it was meaningful that the Dolphins really relied on a pair of freshmen at attack. Bo Hunter finished with 3 goals and 1 assist. Jack Pucci, who was originally a Marquette commit, finished with 3 assists. Also really notable, Jeremy Winston, a midfielder around whom there was a lot of buzz heading into this season, shoots 0 for 8 with 3 turnovers. That was something to keep an eye on as we look for the Dolphins to bounce back from a loss indoors on the road to open the season.
Yeah, Detroit, nice start for them. They play a Notre Dame on the 16th, and they'll have more experience than the Fighting Irish for that game on the 16th. And if you remember that wonderful playoff game years ago when Detroit gave Notre Dame everything they could handle. So that's looking like it's not going to be an easy first game for the Fighting Irish.
That actually reminds me. So Jordan Halpe, who was the long stick midfielder for that Titan team, is the NCAA career record holder for caused turnovers. Keep an eye on Craig Chick as he is within averaging 2.5 caused turnovers per game away from breaking that record in his senior season. He had 5 in the Mountain Hawks win over NJIT on Saturday.
Yeah, Lehigh, the flag planters, they're at Hofstra on Saturday. Little homecoming for Kevin Cassis on the island at the Coliseum Deli.
We'll bring this in for a close with a couple of scrimmage rumors. Loyola 15-5 over Richmond in Baltimore. And I saw John Desco's post-scrimmage press conference after their scrimmage against Yale on Saturday. He said that Yale got off to a hot start. Cuse battled back. Steven Rapus and Tucker Dordovic did not play. However, he said that he expects both of them to be ready for their season opener in the Dome against Colgate on Friday.
Yeah, good to see Lucas Quinn score 2 goals. That was a guy that I had high expectations for. He was an Under Armour All-American 2 years ago, but as a freshman last year, didn't really see the field much for the Orange. He gets off to a good start with Dordovic on the Pines. Brad Voigt had a hat trick. It's a rough start, though. I mean, honestly, you're playing Yale, and Yale had 1 official practice and jumps up 12-4 at halftime. That's impressive.
Well, they're the defending national champions for a reason. Did you hear about any other scrimmages?
I did not. No, the only other thing I wanted to Virginia scrimmaged Towson. I have to find out about that one. Hopkins scrimmaged Marquette. Hopefully the Blue Jays were able to get some of that chocolate-covered bacon in Milwaukee because it's really good. Well, how about Rutgers? Adam Sherlambides back in the action.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He looked awesome.
Yeah, you know, that's great to see. I really feel for guys. I never had to deal with anything, you know, like a Grant Amon missing a year or Adams missed 2 years now. Only thing that stood out from the Rutgers box score was freshman Ben Pounds started in goal. Scarlet Knights traveled to lovely St. John's on Saturday.
One thing we're going to have to look into going all the way back around to the beginning of this podcast, notice that Vermont faceoff specialist Charlie Erdman not only didn't play, is not on the Catamounts roster. So we'll be looking into that one. Check out InsideLacrosse.com this week for that and all the other news. And thank you, as always, for listening. If you like what you heard, both leave a rating and a review, certainly on Apple Podcasts, but whatever other service you use to listen to it, subscribe, tell a friend, hit us up on social media. He's at Hugh Kesnick on Twitter. I am at Terrence Foy. Like I said, there will be more podcasts all week, so make sure to check back for In the Crease podcast on Tuesday, and we'll get the rest of the in-season lineup rolling from there. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with a quick restart.
Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check, testing 1, 2, 3, poke check, rap check, back check, slap check.
Welcome to the quick restart. We cover 73 Division I men's lacrosse teams.
And we do it fast.